Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us as I basically say that every single program, and I am thankful that you are tuning in and listening to what we have to share with you on the program. Every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time, we stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are also rebroadcast on Sundays at 3 p.m. Pacific time at a2zen.fm, and we archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. So we encourage you to check out all of those opportunities for you to tune in and listen in and gather information, go to the guests' websites and find out what's going on in their world, which is part of what this program is about, as I've described it, it's like Christmas. As a matter of fact, that was the analogy that came to me about, well, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years ago as I was doing interviews, and I thought, man, this is really cool. I get to open up this brand new package. I don't know what's in it. I don't know where we're going or what we're going to find out. But then I get to incorporate the things that I want that resonate with me into my life. I don't have to take everything. And by leaving anything, nothing's harmed. And then I get to continually do that. And I have the distinct pleasure of doing that with this program and have been for over 30 years. I can only imagine it's got to be, I don't know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people I've interviewed in over 30 years. And so you can imagine the influences that I have had in my life. Well, we're going to be influenced again today in regards to 5 insights for a fulfilled life. I have been using the term, the concept that I think most of us are tired of surviving, which is what most of us do, especially in the West, in this particular system. We want to thrive. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. And part of the process is having gratitude for the things you currently have, the things you currently are, the place where you are, both physically as well as mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. And to that end, we are going to have with us on the program today the author of Gratitude and Beyond, 5 Insights for a Fulfilled Life. His name is Alan G. Hunter. He's also the author of The Path of Synchronicity. Boy, that would also be a fun topic, as well as 11 books in total. He's also written Spiritual Hunger. He's also written, Princess Frogs, and actually it's Princesses Frogs and Ugly Sisters. Write Your Own Memoirs, The 6 Archetypes of Love. I mean, it's just, and then one other one here is Stories We Need to Know. Now, there's a program we need to do as well, Alan. Thank you so much for joining us on the program.
It's a real pleasure to be with you, Richard. Thank you.
And of course, you know, before we even started, you know, I'm looking at obviously the title of the book, which I've seen here since the book arrived a few weeks ago. And I mean, it sounds like one of those things that a superhero might say, gratitude and beyond, and boom, transformation, and off they go flying through the air and having a great time. And really, it's amazing. You talk about something that many of my guests talk about, yeah, in regards to what makes life work. And yeah, I've heard the word grace, which I know is a part of that, but more so it's being grateful or having, and which is a root, if you will, being grateful or having gratitude.
Yes.
For what is, and yes, who you is, to use improper English.
Yes, exactly. It's very easy for us to get caught up in the daily swirl of all sorts of things and to forget just to breathe and look around and say, oh, it's really pretty neat to be alive. Even though it might not be perfect weather, or even though I have many worries, as we all do, yet to be here in this particular moment, you know, Ram Dass says, be here now, is just wonderful. If you can pause for long enough just to savor that second, that moment, that minute or two. And most of us forget this. Most of us forget this on a regular basis and get caught up in the whirl of our ego concerns.
Well, try this one on for size. You know, you quoted Ram Dass in how exciting it is to be here now. And I went through a program many years ago. It's interesting. The older I get, the more many years there are between here and there. But I was going through a personal growth and development program. It was actually, I can tell the name. It was at that time, I don't even know if it's still in business. It was called LifeSpring. People used to think it was Est, but it was something quite different. I am not following anyone from that particular program. But they would tell us within the first few hours of our uneasiness at not knowing what was coming, that, you know, facing the great void of personal growth and development, that each one of us that was in the room wanted to be there. And that if we didn't want to be there, we wouldn't be. But obviously we did, because we are. And a lot of people sometimes throughout their lives, you know, I really don't want to be here. And it's like when they're in that state, you don't want to, you know, really make them angry. But the reality is, oh, that's not true. Obviously you did, because here you are. And you chose it, whether you like it or not, you chose it. And so let's talk a little bit about not just the aspect of being here and now, but the aspect of accepting the fact that if you didn't want to be here listening to this program, or in your case, Alan, being a participant in this interview, or myself, we would be somewhere else right now.
We would. We have that freedom. We can choose any time we like to go somewhere different, to do something different, not to opt in. So, yes, we're here because of a series of choices that we've made. Some of them we might not have been terribly conscious of making, but we're here, and perhaps it's good to take responsibility for that.
Ooh, dirty word. I remember, and it doesn't even have just, you know, has more than four letters in it. I remember back in my days at the Christian radio station, boy, you didn't like to hear that word, because either God did it or the devil did it. It was like I was being told basically that I was a puppet on a string being manipulated by forces that I do not understand. And over the course of 15 years there, I came to the realization that it was just the opposite. And I would use the analogy of a man or woman walking through this beautiful meadow, and they have a contrite and humble spirit, and they're walking around holding their personal will in their hands and just saying, I want to do God's will. I want to do God's will. And they toss it up into the sky. And God is just moved to tears that one of his creation wants to do his will. He catches the individual's will in his hand, and he starts compressing it down into the size of a baseball. And then he hurls it back at the individual like a 90-mile-an-hour Nolan Ryan fastball, smacks him square in the forehead, and basically says, then do something with the life I gave you. You are not a puppet on a string being manipulated by forces you do not understand. I gave you this life. Do something with it.
Yes, yes. What a wonderful comparison that is. Because, that's where I agree with you totally. We are here to do something. And the trouble is, we tend to get confused and think, oh, I am a puppet on a string, or I have to obey the expectations of my family or my friends or my neighbors, and therefore, I am not doing anything. I am being pushed around to fit into somebody else's slot. Now, I don't think that that's either sensible or even particularly sane. I think we have to take charge, as it were, of that baseball and say, oh, I'm here to do something. I wonder what it is. And then we need to start asking the important questions about what it is we have, in my phrase, to give back. What is it that each of us has to give back? And it doesn't take too much looking before we discover that even the least able of us actually has a lot to hand back to this world. And that's the baseball you're talking of. We have to catch it and say, okay, let's get on with this. We all have something we can contribute.
Yeah. Now, you... I mean, aside from being an author, you're also a professor of literature, so you know the power of words.
Yes.
You know how powerful they can be. And also how, I'll use the term impotent, they can also be, especially when we translate from one language to another.
Yes.
And we have gotten into this discussion on many programs, especially when it comes to specifically the translating into other languages from the original of what I like to call the ancient wisdom teachings, whether they be from the Bible, the Bhagavad Gita, the Quran, the Buddhist, Zen, I mean, and the list goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
And so when you are talking about gratitude, where can you give us, if not the etymology of the word, give us from your perspective the meaning, the soul of what this word is. I don't know if I want to use the word should be or can be or is to us who choose to use it.
Well, that's exactly why I wrote this book. It's based on a personal experience when I became very, very ill and nearly died. And by a chain of almost miraculous circumstances, I was brought back to health. And of course, at the end of that time, when I was back to my health, I was very grateful. In the conventional sense, I was very pleased to still be alive, to have my health back, and I felt that there was something more I could do. But the whole point about this book is that this event happened many years ago, and it wasn't until perhaps 15 years afterwards that I began to look at it and say, wait a second, is there more to this word gratitude than I think?
Mm-hmm.
And the more I looked at it and the more I prodded at it, what I discovered was that gratitude as we understand it, saying thank you to the divine or to whatever it is you thank, is just the first step of a process, of a very important process that moves us away from our total absorption in the things that we tend to get caught up in and moves us into a different relationship to our world and to ourself. Because each of these five insights is a step in which we can, if we choose, and we have to choose, if we choose it, we can diminish that tired, sad, wounded, nasty part of ourselves that sometimes gets called the ego. I like to think of it as the frightened parts of the self. But to do that, we have to go through a series of steps in order to liberate ourselves from it. And so, really, you might say the whole of the book is a redefinition of this word, gratitude, because so many people will say, oh, yes, you know, I'm very grateful for everything I have. I have a gratitude diary, and that's wonderful. But there is much further we can take this idea if we're really interested in following the sensation right through to where it can take us. So that's why I wrote the book.
Well, you know, a couple of images come to mind as you're sharing this aspect of gratitude. One is in an interview that I did with a gentleman who's traveled numerous times to various parts of Africa. I said, you know, I've never been there, but I've seen lots of pictures, you know, and it's like I've never been skiing, but I've seen lots of pictures of the high mountains of Colorado, but I've never broken a leg looking at the pictures. So there you go. But I said to him, I says, is it only for the cameras that we're seeing here in the United States that these people living in Africa are wearing these brightly colored clothes and walking around with smiles, even in these villages, these straw huts? They don't have indoor plumbing, and they don't have cable TV or satellite TV and the internet and smartphones and all this. And yet they seem to be so happy. And what comes to mind is, and grateful for the life that they have. And they express that through their faces as well as through these incredibly brightly colored clothes. I says, is that genuine? Are they really doing it? I said, oh, yeah. And I thought, wow. And yet they don't have all of the wonderful modern conveniences. We call them anyway, modern conveniences. Sometimes they're not so convenient. And yet we walk around with all of this, and yet we'll wear the drabbest of clothes and color and the sourest of, I mean, I look at people who are much older than I, and I'm just entering my 50s. I'm 52, be 53. And they are walking around with that, you know, frown and the you know.
Isn't that the truth? Isn't that
And I'm
the
going,
truth?
Yeah. And were you born that way? Because that looks cemented. You know, and I feel kind of sad for them. I do.
Yes, yes. And that's exactly what happens, because so many people get caught up in this whole business of amassing dollar bills, of buying toys that they can't really afford, of trying to pay for things that they're not really sure they want, of entering into the sort of social blackmail that says, I have to have all of these things, whether I'm going to mortgage my soul for them or not, I still feel I have to have them. And I sometimes think that some of the people I've come across in poorer cultures, and mm-hmm. I've traveled in India, I've traveled in Africa, they have a greater sense of gratitude, because actually life is so precarious. They don't know, some of them, people I've spoken to, certainly in India, they used to ask me, oh, when are you coming back? And I said, well, you know, maybe I'll come back in a year or two. And this one lady said, oh, I don't know if I'll still be alive then. And I thought, gosh, you don't look that old. But life for her was so precarious, getting food was such a difficult thing for her, as she was a widow, that really she couldn't bank on being there if I were to come back. Now, if I say that, that sounds like a depressing circumstance. But she was one of the most light-hearted and tender and loving and gentle souls you could possibly imagine, or at least I could possibly imagine. Perhaps I'm romanticizing her at this point in time. But I think that the difference was that when she, obviously she had her life struggles and her life was hard, but she also was able to say life is hard and it can be beautiful. It can be extremely beautiful, not because one is surrounded by beautiful things, but because there is beauty in everything,
right,
if you know where to look for it, if you pay attention. And that's one of the insights, is that ability to drop the ego that says, oh, I ought to be doing this, or I must do this, or I can't possibly do anything else, and just be in the space of accepting that this is a beautiful world if we open ourselves up to it. There's ugliness, of course there is, but the ugliness is not as prevalent as the beauty. And that's true just about anywhere you can imagine. There is beauty to be found in the eyes of all people. You know, I've worked in very many strange places. I've worked in prisons, for goodness sake. We're in the maximum security prison here in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. the Supermax. And there's beauty to be found there. You wouldn't think there is, but the interactions between some of the people, beautiful. Absolutely heartwarming. It's almost as though we have so many toys here in our world that we get confused about what really matters. And so you have the cliche, don't you? I mean, we all have the cliche of the man who works so hard to look after his children, but he never gets to see them or watch their soccer games or laugh with them around the dining room table. And I say, you know, that's a noble thing you're doing, Mr. Devoted Parent there, but actually you've got the balance way wrong. Is it possible to change it? Could you change it? Yes, you could, especially in this wonderful country. We won't starve to death. In India, the lady I was talking about and many of the people I spoke to, they probably could starve to death, but we won't. So it's a choice, it's a mistaken choice that we continue to choose the bright, glittery toys that are around us. And, oh, there are so many to choose from.
Yeah.
But we choose them rather than saying, what's going to feed the soul? What's going to bring me into connection with people? What's going to grow the love in my heart?
Yeah.
And that's what really is what gratitude can lead you towards. Gratitude breaks you. It breaks you open like an eggshell. And suddenly, when you're grateful, You can't be a superhero, you know. You can't be a rule unto yourself, because you recognize a debt to somebody or something else.
Yeah.
And when that little crack breaks you open, it opens your heart as well. And the ego, that pesky ego that wants to look better than the neighbors, that wants a shinier car, that ego begins to shrivel. And with each step we make through gratitude, it shrivels a little more, and it takes us into an entirely different relationship. to our lives.
Well, the way you have this mapped out, it's a five-pointed star. And, of course, you have gratitude, humility, beauty, innocence, and a sense of connection to nature and our place in the universe, which for some is kind of hard because we have been made, well, I'm not sure if the right phrasing is we have been made to, as opposed to we have chosen to, but we have been made to feel insignificant by our surroundings, especially our peers, and many of us growing up in school, grade school, high school, and so forth, and by our parents and others in our neighborhoods and other associations. And it's hard to think of ourselves as being even remotely connected to the vastness of the universe and what's happening when those kinds of messages are given to us. And again, it kind of goes back to the power of the word that is used.
Yeah.
And that's a hard, for some, it's a hard thing to overcome. I myself am sort of a product of the school end of it from grade school and high school. And I've witnessed others who went through similar situations, and they became such introverts. They became so secluded, and they just wanted nothing to do with the outside world, and they pursued other endeavors. And I'm sitting here going, well, how in the heck did I wind up here? You know, what in the world happened? And then I even think about, my gosh, what if I had been able to pursue these paths years prior? In other words, the years where I was going through that mess, why did I have to go through? Why couldn't I have started earlier? I mean, I can't imagine where I'd be today. And it isn't so much a regret as much as it is looking even at the children of today, because I'm hearing the stories of bullying, and I remember starting to hear those like at the turn of the 21st century and thinking, what, we're still dealing with that? I thought we were done. I thought when I got out of high school, it was over. Well, it was for me, but it didn't stop, and the kids are still being taught how to be bullies.
That's exactly it. You know, there are some lessons in life, like bullying, like gratitude, that actually we have to renew just about every day.
Mm.
We have to keep reminding ourselves. You know, it's not a one-shot deal where we learn the lesson and we say, oh, thanks very much, got it. No, we have to keep learning. Oh, the ego, the thing that we have that guides us through our day for the most part, is very wonderful, but it's not in charge of the totality of me. We have to learn that bullying can be confronted today, but it'll probably come up again tomorrow. We know this because, you know, World War II was, of course, the war against fascism. Fascism hasn't disappeared. It's still there in various places, and we still have to work with our people, especially our young people, to say, you know, this is not really a useful way to respond to the world. You know, let's look at it in terms of trying to find a better way to respond to the world. And we have to do that with every generation. I know this, of course, because as a college professor, I see generation and generation of students coming to me, and they're all a little different every year, and they all need to learn the same lessons in terms of what their heart needs to learn. They need to key in to this vital space that says, I feel called to do this because it is authentic to who I am. And everyone's path is different. Nobody has the same path. You know, you can't look at the class and say, okay, you guys over there, you're all going to be lawyers. You guys over there, you're all going to be engineers. New people at the front, you know, you're going to be accountants. You just can't do that because that's feeding into the you are your job idea.
Mm.
What I'm trying to suggest to everybody and in all of my books is we are what we can give back to our world and our society.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm thinking in terms here of finding your place in nature. We're all part of nature, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All of the elements that are outside in the world, I mean, look out of your window, there's probably a building and grass and trees and flowers. You know, all of these elements exist in the world, and they all exist inside us, and they have always been there. When we die, those elements will be recycled. We are not different from the rest of the world. We just think we are.
Yeah.
We're not
yeah.
separate from our neighbors. We just have a really nasty habit of saying, oh, that's them and this is me.
Yeah.
That can serve you only a short period of your life when you're trying to work out what is authentic to the interior of your abilities and your knowledge. But for the rest of the time, we have to look about and say, I'm the same as everything around me I see. Now, how can I be part of making it better? What is my particular gift? And you know, some people have a particular gift. Some people become very famous because of their particular gift. That's nice. But I think we all have a particular gift that we look right past, and that is we can be loving and helpful to other human beings. We can be accepting and generous and kind, and occasionally we have to protest at the treatment we get from other human beings in
right.
a loving way.
Right.
And if we can key into that, we are going to be giving back to our society and to our planet. Mm. You know, we can't pollute our planet without actually slapping ourselves in the face, because that pollution, that air pollution, that water pollution, you name it, that piece of garbage, it's still going to be here. We're still going to trip over it one day. Why do we think that we can throw these things aside and it won't matter?
Yeah.
That's crazy ego thinking.
It's as if it disappears and it doesn't. Yeah.
It appears. It appears.
Oh, absolutely.
It
yes.
It appears mm-hmm. because we are determined to see it that way whilst we fulfill another agenda, a rather unhealthy agenda.
Yeah.
But if we started thinking just a little more thoughtfully, it would change just about everything that we do. And perhaps we can all do that, one person at a time. We can start changing the way we do things.
Alan Hunter's my guest. This is Tell Me Your Story, his book, Gratitude and Beyond. And your website is alanhunter.net if people want
yeah.
to get more information about you and your plethora of books. And I'm sure there are more in the works. Even as we speak, you're probably writing as you're talking here. No, you're probably not. But nonetheless, I know that there are those who are just so prolific when it comes to writing. And I'm still in my 13th year working on a little book having to do with choices. And that's kind of what we're talking about here is, and then of course that's what this program is about, choices and knowledge of those choices. And I phrase it that way because there are choices that you may not even know existed. I use a prime example. I use myself and my wife back in the year 2005, 2006, when I found out that they were selling the radio station I was working for. And even though the owners had said, oh, no, we're not going to change the format, they did and laid everybody off as of February 28th of 2006. And my wife calls me up March 1st of 2006 and says, I just quit my job. And I thought, okay, well, you know, now we're both unemployed. But, you know, we had a little nest egg, so we were able to do something. But then we decided, okay, well, what do we want to do here? And so we made the choice to come to Santa Barbara, which is her hometown, for a week and do a little R&R, as it were. And we went back home, put the house up for sale, and we drove into our new rental property on May 9th at 2:30 in the morning after a 12-hour drive across the desert from Phoenix, which normally only takes 8. But it didn't even feel like 8. I mean, it was as if we were so in the moment. We were so in that space of the adventure that it was like, oh, we're already here? Really? It was just so incredible. But there was also no fear. But we made that choice. And that choice
beautiful.
Has spawned a new choice after a new choice after a new choice. Experiences that I would never have had, that she never would have had, had we not come here. So,
oh, what a wonderful story.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Marvelous.
And we just, again, we don't know. We just don't know. And so to not choose, granted, is still a choice, but to not choose and just to sit there is really unfortunate. When we come back, I want to talk more about this and choices and gratitude and beyond to discuss the process of what is beyond gratitude. And we'll talk about the other three or four points on the star that we haven't really discussed yet. As we continue here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, I'm Richard Dugan. Stay right there.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Oh, this is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. And we will be here every Saturday at this same time from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time, streaming live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We archive the programs, and we are also rebroadcast on A to Zen.fm at 3 p.m. Pacific time on Sundays. So please join us, and join us as we also talk with our guests, as well as our regular contributor, Beth McDonald of BethMcDonaldConsulting.com, and we encourage you to check her out as well. But right now we're talking with Alan Hunter. He's the author of Gratitude and Beyond, and it is about the five insights for a fulfilled life. Those five insights are quite simple. They're, I say simple, but we're going to get into more of a description thereof, having to do with gratitude, humility, beauty, innocence, and nature, or as the expanded version here is, the sense of connection to nature and our place in the universe, as we described at the latter parts of our last segment together here, Alan. And it, again, it's great to have you with us on the program. I guess that when I have the opportunity to talk with people on these levels, I think about, especially when you were talking earlier, I think about television programs that have come out in the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years that have actually been quite extraordinary. One in particular that speaks to this discussion we had about our place in the universe is a program. I don't know if you've seen it. I don't know how much television you watch. I'm intrigued by it. I'm not real thrilled with some of the violence that's in it, but nonetheless, the general premise, the paradigm that it presents, it's a television program called Touch.
About
this little boy and his father. The little boy does not speak, or at least hadn't until this season, but he spoke primarily in numbers. And his father had to figure out a way to decipher these numbers and what they meant and where, and they began this adventure to try to figure out what's going on. Well, you would see other people with other stories in this episode, and these stories would intersect. They would not necessarily meet each other, but actions taken by person A in city A would somehow intersect with the actions taken by person B in city B, would then intersect with actions taken by person C in city C, et cetera, et cetera. They would never meet each other per se, but you were seeing how each person carrying out their life's purpose, if you will, even if they weren't conscious of it, they weren't consciously aware of it, would affect. It's like with my wife, she works for a local cardiovascular department in a local clinic here in Santa Barbara. And she has no idea the role that the individual who has come into her facility with the doctors that she works with, she has no idea how her attitude and her patient-focused care will impact the person coming in, who may come in with just the lousiest of dispositions. But after being with her for 5 minutes, and they're off to maybe a heavy board meeting, okay, or maybe a family reunion because they're retired and so forth, and they leave there almost turned around, and who knows, that disposition of that CEO or what have you going off to that board meeting could change the course. Now when I use that term, change the course, of history, and I hear that phrase on the History Channel, I'm thinking, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. So did you know what the course of history was going to be? So that sidebar aside, we just don't know the impact that our lives are going to have on the totality of the world.
Precisely so, yes. And maybe that's why we have to be so careful and so loving, because we know they will have an impact. We can't predict what that impact will be. In fact, it's probably better if we don't try to predict the impact. We just have to go about doing the best we can and have faith, trust that things are going to work out to be better.
Do you remember do you remember the author James Redfield and his book Celestine Prophecy?
Yes, indeed, yes.
And how he says we all have messages for one another?
We do. I think we do.
Yeah.
The point is, are we going to listen for those messages? I think your wife is a wonderful example of someone who is doing her job, but she's also sending a message that is a caring, loving message to all these folks who come into her clinic. And some of them are going to listen and be changed, and some of them aren't going to listen, because that's the nature of people.
Yeah.
But she's doing the world a huge favor just by continuing to put that message across.
Yeah.
And that not look for any reward. It's often been said that if we look for rewards, we taint our behavior. I think that's probably true. I think the people who create the most change in the world are not those who are planning and plotting and manipulating. Oh, if I'm nice to this person, then I will get ahead in the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's rather too calculating. What we have to do, I think, as human beings, is accept that we are just the same as everybody else, and treat them perhaps even a little better than we would treat ourselves, because most of us aren't very good at loving ourselves. Can we be better to others? That would be a good place to start.
You know, the golden rule, of course, being, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I heard that twisted around just a little bit in a very appropriate way for what you've just shared. And it goes like this. Do unto others as if you were the others. And I thought, wow, yeah. And I even talk with people about this. Years ago when I used to, I'm never officially counseled anybody, but it's always been in conversation of friendship and the relationships and things of that nature. And I said, how do you feel about, you know, speaking poorly about someone to their face and saying mean and nasty things and all of that kind of stuff? And, oh no, I don't want to. He's my friend. She's my wife and lover and partner and this and that and the other, and close commitment to some kind of a relationship. And I said, then why do you say those things to yourself?
Yeah, exactly. Beautifully put. Yeah, why do we say the things we say to ourselves and not love ourselves? If we're going to love others, it's a really good way to start by loving ourselves, by actually being kind and forgiving to ourselves. Forgiving others is wonderful, but it starts with forgiving yourself. It starts with realizing, oh, I'm part of the problem too, whatever the problem is. And if someone has offended me, yeah, I'll forgive them, but then I also have to be loving to myself in this whole matter, whatever it is.
But that also takes us takes us back to what we talked about at the beginning of the program, having to do with the messages that we've received as we've grown through childhood and adolescence.
Yes.
What is your observation and or suggestion, counsel if you will, to those wanting to break those chains from the past? What are your suggestions as far as steps that we can take? Where do we begin?
Well, I think most of those chains from the past are what we have created for ourselves.
They never really existed.
They never really existed. We nurtured them, we forged them, we hammered them solidly out of good steel because our wounded self thought that this was what we had to do, this is how we had to behave in order to get the love that we felt we didn't get. So we've really done this to ourselves, most of us. And that's the hardest thing for most people to realize. When I counsel someone in a bad relationship, and they blame the other person, they say, oh, she is horrible and does this and that and the other, the hardest thing for them to hear is, well, actually, you're part of the problem because you allowed them to keep doing that and stayed in the relationship or didn't challenge them. So in some ways, we do create circumstances, not all the time, of course, but to some extent we create circumstances because we don't feel we deserve better.
Well,
that is a...
Go ahead.
Sorry, you were going to say something?
I was going to say, and that's the same thing that I say, and I've actually said, to talk show hosts. Especially when you're talking politics. I remember even going to one of them off air. I just casually, very kindly saying, you know, I can appreciate where you're coming from, whether I agree with you politically or otherwise. I can appreciate where you're coming from. But have you ever considered the possibility that you created part of the problem because you let them get away with what you claim they're getting away with? You know, I mean, if you're that hell bent, but if you're that hell bent for leather against these people on the other side of the aisle, whatever the name, whatever the designations are for the duality, okay, Protestant, Catholic, you know, Republican, Democrat, Tory, Whig, whatever, you know what? You created the problem by letting them do it, by letting them get away with it, if you will. So, and then the other element of it was that. Don't you have to give them credit for your having something to talk about? Because if they weren't there, you would be sitting here in silence.
Yeah, that's
so
it.
Without
that's
them,
exactly
you
it.
Wouldn't have a program.
Mm.
You know?
Yes.
And in a manner of speaking, we wouldn't have a program if life and if the world weren't going in the direction that we're going and we were wanting to find those new ways of living, those new paradigms for a new world. Because the world we're living in, we're not real happy with. I mean, okay, now there's a real paradox for you. We're not real happy with the world in which we live, and yet at the same time, I'm sure you're probably of the persuasion that we need to be grateful for the world in which we live today, no matter how it appears. I don't want to say no matter how messed up it is, because you say that, and you give the gratitude, and then you take it away. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, indeed. Yes,
so indeed. How do we deal with that paradox? Or
well,
is it?
I think the paradox is exactly as you say, that the paradigm is the part of the problem. The pattern we've set up is a sort of us against them, whoever us is and whoever they are. And it's the oldest mind game in the book. But it's usually set up in a way that is not sustainable if you look at it closely. What we discover is that the them is in fact us, most of the time. And here is the point, you see. Most people would like to get into a fight and be right. Mm. They would rather be right than be happy.
I've heard that before.
I can only say it feels terribly true all of the time. And I've done it myself.
Yes. Oh, here. My hand is up.
None of us, I think, none of your listeners, none of us can plead total innocence on this one.
Yeah.
Because we like to be right, and that's what we've been brought up to in our Western society. I don't know too much about Eastern societies, so I won't blanket them with the same term, but we're brought up to get the right answer, to be right, to be better than somebody else, be quicker, answer the question first, get a higher mark, to run faster, to you name it. It's all about doing it better and responding to a judgment from some entity that is a little fuzzy and a little ill-defined, but is felt very powerfully. And so for us, part of the language, the unwritten language that is imprinted on our subconscious is, I have to be right. I have to be right a lot of the time, or I don't have any status. I find this with my students, especially students and the people I counsel as well, of course, but especially young people at the age of 20 to, say, 25 who are going into professions where you have to be right. So the nursing profession or accountancy or whatever, you have to be absolutely right and you have to be certain. And we wouldn't want it any other way. And that's fine. That's one form of right. But when they then translate that rightness, that what I call competence, that wonderful sureness that makes them good nurses or doctors or accountants, when they translate that to human values like, you know, how to raise a child, or when it's correct to confront somebody and how they confront someone, or what politics may be, that's when we lose track of what's really going on. And I think the trouble is that we're so trained to get ahead for those jobs that we're told are so hard to get. And yes, they are hard to get. But if we fixate on that type of thinking, it's going to be really, really difficult for us to break away and say, wait a second, what is the best outcome? Not the one that looks best for me, not the one that allows me to wave flags and blow whistles and say how great I am, but what actually would the best outcome be? Mm. And that's a wholly different thing. So, for example, if I go back to my life, because your program has always been wonderful for looking at life stories and how we do things, I brought all of this disaster that nearly destroyed my health, that nearly killed me, I brought it all on myself because I thought I had to be good at my job, which was a very demanding job, and I wasn't that good at it. I thought I had to make my relationship work. I thought I had to prove to people that I could do everything and anything. And I almost destroyed myself and my health in the process. Oh, and did I mention I was trying to keep my parents happy at the same time? You know, I was trying to make everybody happy and look good because I desperately needed something that I didn't have, which was I didn't have an inner sense of who I was and that I was actually okay the way I was.
So you were in quite a circus as a plate spinner. And you were a plate spinner with multiple plates going and trying to keep them all going.
Yes, indeed. And it's not a very comfortable place to be.
No.
Especially as I didn't know how long the performance was going to last.
Yeah, really.
Am I just doing this for a few minutes, or is it the rest of my life? And when I realized, oh, it's the rest of my life, that's when my body rebelled. My mind, my ego, was plugging away, but my body said, no, stop it now. And so it brought me low. And then when I left my job, which meant I gave up my home, and I left England, and I limped on with this relationship, which in fact my fiancé, it turned out it didn't work out as a relationship. When I left all that behind, I could have looked at myself as some kind of failure. Oh, I didn't make the cut. You know, I tried the best. I didn't have what it takes. Instead of which, because I was grateful to be alive and be breathing again, I began to think differently and say, wait a second, this isn't a defeat. This is a setback, but it's the sort of setback that is asking me, think again. Think again. You can run your life a different way, a way that doesn't destroy you. Now, I give you that example because the number one killer in the United States today is, of course, heart disease. And that's caused by stress. And stress is what we do to ourselves. So we, in this wonderful country, which is so rich and beautiful and magnificent, we, most of us, it seems, are busy driving ourselves into the ground and doing to ourselves the unloving thing called stress. And it's destroying us. It's destroying us in large quantities. It doesn't have to be that way. Many people have a crisis and change, thank goodness, and they wake up. But still, it is one of the number one killers in this country. And can't overlook that.
Yeah. Well, you raise a very interesting point, too, and in terms of it doesn't have to be that way with a lot of things. I talk with people especially about these new ways of living, and of course there's all the different layers, education and economic and social and medical, you know, and so on and so on. I mean, just every level. And my question to an individual who is really invested in a given system, be it religious or educational or especially economic, my question is, Who said it has to stay this way? Who said this is the only form that will work? And people will argue, well, look around the world and look down through history and look at America is the greatest. And I hear this constantly from people who have never left American soil. They say this is the greatest country on earth. Mm-hmm. And my first question to them is, have you lived anywhere else for any period of time? Have you? It's like one of my previous guests who has letters after her name for all of these different studies in different religions, be they Christianity or Buddhism, Zen, Islamic faith, Universalist Church, and on. And so she's looked into all of these different belief systems. So, and it's primarily to assist in the counseling of people so that she knows where they're coming from.
Yeah.
And I sit here and I ask that question. Have you lived anywhere else? Have you tried living under another form of religion or government or economics to see how it would work? And just because we have had, let's just say for the sake of argument, Alan, we've had 10 different economic systems through the course of human history. Does that mean that there are only 10 forms of economic systems and we've found number 10 that works?
Yeah.
It's like science. Beautiful. It's like science saying we found the laws of the universe and there are 10. And then next year they find number 11. Ah, now we have 11 laws of the universe and yet there are 10,000 laws of the universe and we've only found 11.
Yes, that's a beautiful example, isn't it? And those are the mind-forged manacles that the poet William Blake used to talk about, the things that we box ourselves in with. And surely, you know, a religious system is a wonderful thing, and I don't criticize anybody's religious system or their devotion. And yet, I think every religious system, everyone that I've looked at, has got part of it that says, you know, this is just one way of looking at things, and this is not the only way of looking at things. That's what we find in the holy books, although when religions become large corporations,
things start to change,
everything solidifies.
Yeah.
And well, it has been said that you know, every system starts as free-floating, open to change, and at a certain moment, every culture writes what we might call its Bible.
Yeah.
And from that point on, it's crystallized, and it's starting to die.
I heard a great phrase once that that truth is truth until it is written down.
Well, yes, that's a good way to describe it. Yeah. Yes.
And you raise another good point too, and that is, and again, I mean nothing but the most respect for all of the various belief systems that are out there, but then I would throw this out to an individual. Are you devoted to your belief system to the point where you're willing to take 5 times out of your day to literally stop everything and pray? Well, the Muslims do this. Are you willing to take time out of your day once a week to go to Mass or once a day in the morning before you go to work to participate in the celebration of the Mass? The Catholics, many, many Catholics do it.
They certainly do.
The Hindu, I mean, and you can go down the list of the levels of devotion by individuals. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, but the argument, well, I'm too busy. I have to get to work at such and such a time. Well, wait a minute. These people over here in these other countries are just as committed to their free enterprise system, if you will, want to use that term, as you are, and they find the time.
Yes, they do.
I think it kind of comes down to that. And again, no disrespect to an individual's choices that they've made, but when you start criticizing somebody else's way of doing things, you need to stop and say, am I as committed to my belief system, to my paradigms, to my my version of God, if you will, as they are? And then you start realizing, oh my gosh. And again, you don't want to start, here comes the slippery slope, because you start beating yourself up.
Exactly.
We don't want that.
No. We're not about beating ourselves or, in fact, anyone else.
Or anyone else,
that's
yeah.
really that's really beautiful, you know, because every religious system has its devotions, and many of them are really tremendously moving. And, of course, there are many ways to God. There are many paths to God. And that's perhaps one of the reasons that I like one of the world's oldest religions, Hinduism, mm-hmm. because it accepts every other belief system into it, saying, oh, well, this is just part of the way to approach what is divine. And they do take the divine very seriously, which I think is where we need to be. And not to judge someone else's system, as you say, but to respond sympathetically to that level of devotion and that ability to find what is holy in the world, because that's a very wonderful thing, and not everyone can find it, like 5 times a day or 3 times a day for Mass, or if you're a monk.
Right.
You know, Christian monks prayed, 6 times a day, I mm-hmm. think, in
yeah.
the medieval period. Don't criticize it if you don't practice it. Have some
yeah.
sort of devotion yourself. I think that's true.
As a former Baha'i, I know mm. that the Baha'is teach that if you accept one of the manifestations of God in
yeah.
the various names,
mm-hmm.
then you accept them all. If you reject one of them, you have rejected them all.
Oh, isn't that that's eloquent, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you know, it is, and my experiences, I've had a couple of rabbis on the program over the years,
mm.
and most recently especially, and the conversations that we have are just awe-inspiring from my standpoint, it's like, wow, I never looked at it that way. And then I'm thinking, man, I think I was born into the wrong religion. I should have been born into the Jewish faith, you know, because, I mean, just the font of
mm-hmm.
of wisdom and insight
yeah.
that
yeah.
that I have gained through those conversations, and I hope our listeners as well. You have written a number of books. One of them in particular that I found so intriguing, the title was about synchronicity.
Yes, indeed, yes. I think being in a place of gratitude leads us eventually to a different alignment with the power, the force that runs the laws, if you like, that run the universe, because it does operate according to a system of physical and actual laws. And I suggest that if we get out of our own way, if we stop wanting things just for ourselves and start listening to whatever it is that the universe is telling us, we can be nudged into a place where suddenly all sorts of opportunities that we simply couldn't see before pop up in front of us and arise for our consideration, so that doors that had seemed firmly shut fly open at just the right moment. And this may sound rather fanciful, but it stems from a Hindu idea that the universe is in balance, and that our job is to align ourselves with it. And when we do that, we will be available for whatever it is that needs to be done that the universe throws our way. And that's a different way of looking at us, you know, ourselves. Kennedy, of course, said, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. I'm saying it slightly differently, and that is, listen to the universe and ask of the things that it sends you, ask yourself, now, what am I supposed to do with this that will make for a positive outcome? And when we do that, our whole lives change, our possibilities change, and suddenly, you know, like you journeying through the desert to take residence in your new house, neither your wife nor yourself having a job, when you trust the universe, it supplies the opportunities that, looking back, you say, my goodness, isn't that miraculous? How did that happen? I didn't plan that. Well, yeah, that's the whole point. The more we plan, the less we listen.
Yeah.
And when we stop listening, we simply can't see the opportunities that the universe, that chance, if we will, sends us. And just about everybody who has risen to any eminence, I think will acknowledge this, as well as, of course, the millions of us who haven't risen to any particular eminence, but who have made an impact in the world. What we've noticed is that opportunities come our way, real opportunities, not just to get rich. No, no, it's not about that. Opportunities come our way to make a difference. And when we respond positively, everything changes. And we set in motion a chain of circumstances that are what you might call synchronicity. So that's it in a bit of a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was thinking of the story that I tell people is regarding our sojourn to Santa Barbara and the Central Coast and to the ocean where I've always wanted to be. And that is that on March 1st of that year, we were sitting watching television. And of course, my wife comes over and she's certainly shaken because, you know, there is no level of certainty as to what's going to come next because, we're both unemployed. But she said something rather profound. She asked the question. She says, I feel like we're on the edge of a precipice. And I shared with her, with everything that I have done over the years with interviews and personal growth and development and the books that I've read and so forth, I come to only one conclusion that most of these writings and individuals have shared. And it's not the Thelma and Louise solution where you come to the edge of a cliff and you drive a car off of it. But it's sort of similar. And it is when you come to the edge, when you come to a cliff, you do two things. You jump and you trust.
That's it.
Now, it is sort of the Thelma and Louise, but they weren't. This was quite the literal physical kind of thing. We're not speaking of that when you come to the physical cliff, you should jump and trust unless you have hopefully water down at the bottom there. Maybe you can land in it and you can be safe and so on and so forth. But the metaphor, it's the metaphor that we're talking about here.
Definitely.
And that's what we did. And what was so extraordinary for me, and again, going back to this whole business of synchronicity, is that through that whole time from the 28th of February until I secured what has been now a 5-year position. Though after we moved here, there were moments of fear, of uncertainty. But until we arrived here on the 9th of May, there was no fear. And really, I think when we talk about this, I think one phrase comes to mind that I've shared many times on this program, and that is that I have felt that I have been in the right place at the right time all my life.
Ah, wonderful. Wonderful feeling, isn't it?
It's extraordinary. Yeah. And I have had a guest on who talks about the feeling.
Yes.
And having that feeling even when the realities around you aren't supporting that feeling.
Yes, yes. We have to trust that inner knowing, even when everything else says, don't do that, and especially our relatives and friends and loved ones saying, oh, don't do that, oh, you don't want to do that. And yet that is exactly the thing we need to do. And the better we are at listening to ourselves, knowing ourselves, the more easily it comes to us that, okay, this is what I have to do next. It's not rational by the world standards because it's not operating on the same understandings as the world standards, which say keep the safe job, stay on until retirement, save this, do whatever you have to do to stay put and just gradually keep accumulating. Well, that's very nice, but when the call comes, and you might compare it to a Joseph Campbell-like call, the call of the hero, you really have to follow it or miss out on a vital developmental stage in life. And some people can't do that, and that's fine, and they make wonderful citizens and beautiful people, and yet I tend to find that they come to me in counseling sessions in perhaps their 50s saying, you know, I think I missed out somewhere along the way. I wish I hadn't played so safe. And it's not an idle regret that they're voicing. It's a sense of, you know, I think there was something going on and I didn't have the courage to join in. So, yes, I mean, this is part of a different way of looking at the possibilities for one's life. We probably need to do that. Well, I'll give you a little example, actually, because I'm a writer. I spent years trying to write novels and didn't get very far. And then I began to write things that were closer to my heart and had no trouble. Oh, that's lucky. But when I was thinking about this, I was also thinking of some of the great writers of the last century. John Steinbeck, for instance, who won the Nobel Prize, he started his writing career. He said, I want to be a writer, I've got to be a writer. And he did his market research, and his market research suggested that, you know, the sorts of novels that were selling had to be, I don't know, 17th century court dramas set in Europe. So he did all his research, and he wrote four huge novels of 17th century France. Nobody wanted them. Nobody wanted them at all. So he, one day he went out, after writing his fourth one, he went out on a bit of a drunken bender, and he came back and he found that he hadn't let the dog out before he left, and the dog had eaten part of his latest manuscript. So he said, I think this is a message here. I'm not going to write this stuff anymore.
Mm.
And then he turned his eyes to the people he knew who lived around him, who were the poor people of Salinas, California, people living on what was to be tortilla flats, and he started writing about them. And you know, the world simply couldn't get enough of him from that point onwards.
Mm.
You know, wow. It's a wonderful example of, here is a man of genius, and the ego is pointing him in one direction, and then he gets a slap on the side of the face, as it were, that says, don't force it. Do what feels authentic.
Yeah.
The moment he started to do what felt authentic, he was writing important things, life-changing things, world-changing things. You know, the Grapes of Wrath has changed the way we feel about all sorts of things,
yeah,
especially to do with poverty. And he had the courage to go in that direction when he had literally nothing left to lose.
Mm.
It was a case of, well, I'll try this because I haven't anything left to lose. And sometimes that is exactly what we need to do to get into that flow, that synchronous space. And the doors did flow open for him, fly open for him, and they continued to all his life.
You know, it's interesting, using sports analogies, the worst kind of scenario that you want going into a sporting event is to face a team or an individual who has nothing to lose.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because they will basically, they don't care anymore. They're going to go in there and they're just going to do whatever it is that they're going to do. Because if they don't win this game, they're out.
That's it.
You know?
They've got nothing left to lose.
Yeah.
So this is a formidable opponent.
Yeah.
And we know this, and yet we don't apply it to our own lives.
Yeah.
That we're at our most formidable when we have nothing left to lose. The protesters in the Arab world, the Arab Spring, it was very interesting because the press, interesting to me, the press would talk about the protests and how they were getting, you know, more and more agitated. And then the press came up with this little phrase, which was the fear threshold. And you started hearing it on the news that, well, you know, the protesters in Tunisia have passed the fear threshold. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because what was meant by that is exactly what you're saying,
mm-hmm,
that the protesters were saying, you know what, we are so fed up that we don't care if we don't win. We're going to take to the streets, and we're going to protest, and we're going to throw rocks at those tanks.
Yeah.
And when you cross that threshold, you know, I'm not suggesting that we should throw rocks
at
tanks.
Sure, sure.
I'm just saying that this is a wonderful metaphor for what we, perhaps all of us, could do more of in our lives, and that is not to be ruled by fear, but to be ruled by courage, and to be ruled perhaps by love too.
Well,
but courage is not a bad place to start.
The image of Tiananmen Square, of the man standing in front of the tank. Yeah. Basically, he'd had enough. And if you look at it from another more metaphysical or spiritual standpoint, and in terms of not having anything left to lose, if you're living in an oppressive society where you really don't have a life, you're just surviving, then the next life has got to be better than this one. So I don't care. Yeah. You can, and I think I'm trying to remember whether it was Paul or if it was Jesus who made the statement, you know, that they can kill my body, mm-hmm. but they'll never take my soul.
Yes, exactly.
My soul is mine. That. And it will go on, and communism or whatever the regime is, even capitalism, is not going to be able to control my soul. When I depart, when I leave this vehicle. And so it's real interesting that you phrase it that way. Something else you brought up as well. When my first wife and I decided we were going to buy our first house, I told her up front before we even began, I said, look, I know enough about the real estate process and buying a house because I was producing a radio program with a gentleman who was a realtor. I was running the console and so forth. I know all of the ins and outs of it. We have to stay focused on what we're doing here, okay? So I said, here's the phrase. This is the phrase we will live by until we sign the last signature on the papers and we get the keys to the house. The phrase is, we are buying a house, period. We are buying a house. We're not fighting with the appraiser. We're not fighting with the assessor. We're not fighting with the county. We're not fighting with the insurance company as far as homeowners insurance. We're not even fighting with the realtor who is on our side to sell this house to us. Even to the last day, the day of closing, when I get a call at 10 o'clock in the morning and I'm at work and he says, I just picked up the papers and I'm taking them over to the title company and I see you don't have any homeowners insurance. And I said, what? And I told him what I had done over the last two weeks to get this set up. And then I called that insurance company and I gave them an earful. And then when I got off the phone, I had to stop myself. Whoa. You're not fighting the insurance company. Your realtor is taking care of it. Yes, it's going to be a little more expensive and the payments will be only a couple of dollars more. It's not a big deal. And in 6 months, you can change. But what are you doing? You're buying a house.
So at
2 o'clock that afternoon, we signed all the papers and we got the keys to the house. And we were done in 30 days from the day we saw the house. 30 days.
Oh.
Now, this was back in 1993. That is true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it was also during that time, and I wasn't even aware of it, we were going through a bit of a downturn in the real estate market even back then. But I wasn't aware that that was happening. We were buying a house.
That's a beautiful example, isn't it?
So keep your, what is the phrase? Keep your affirmations, because I would consider that to be, keep them short and to the point. We're getting married. We're buying a car. We're going to Ireland for a vacation. That's what we're doing. We're not dealing with the airlines and we're not getting into, because then your energy is so diffused.
Exactly. It's dissipated in ways that it really doesn't need to be dissipated.
So bring us back to that in relation to gratitude as we wrap up the program here.
Well, I think that we have come to a wonderful full circle, and that is, focusing on what is important is right in the center of that wonderful anecdote you told about buying the house. Focus on what is important. What actually is happening, you're buying a house. In terms of gratitude, the most important thing one can do is to say, you know, the world may not be going quite the way I want it to be, and today was kind of a difficult day, and fill in the blanks, but actually, there are substantial things to be grateful for, because everything contains a lesson. Everything. If the day didn't go your way, are we going to give up our happiness just because somebody was rude to us at work, because our boss chewed us out? Is that going to rob me of my happiness? Only if I allow it to. Only if I allow it to.
Yeah.
And if I'm in a place where I'm routinely robbed of my happiness, do I have to put up with that? No. So being grateful means looking for the good in everything. Is there a lesson here? Usually there is in every lesson. And I write about people who have experience what one of them, Andrew Bienkowski, describes as radical gratitude, and that is the ability to look past disasters, real disasters, personal disasters, and say, what is this teaching me? In all this, what is it teaching me? Now, I don't wish a disaster on anybody, but disasters happen. And you know, within each one, we have the choice to rise and move forward and say, there's something here for me to learn, or we can collapse and play victim. And a victim is not grateful. A victim has given up. So gratitude is a remarkable aspect of our nature that asks us to see what is positive in what we have just been through so that we can begin to rebuild our lives accordingly. I can't stress that enough. So that we can begin to rebuild our lives accordingly. I have survived whatever it is, fill in the blank. Now, this gives me the chance to rebuild my life accordingly.
Yeah, no.
Talk to people. Anyone can talk to somebody who's been through a traffic accident or whatever, and the car has been totaled, and they go home and they hug their loved ones and say, oh my God, I'm so glad that I'm alive to hug you. Now, you could say, the world is rotten, and now I've got to buy another car, and I hate the world, and I hate my life. You could do that.
Mm-hmm.
That's an option. Or you can go to the gratitude that is going to open those five awarenesses, that's going to make us humble to realize we're not the only pebble on the beach, that's going to make us see the beauty that exists in our environment, perhaps as you hug your loved one in gratitude, and that will take us back to our essential innocence, because in our core, in our real heart of who we are loving, we are generous, we are trusting. Those three things that perhaps babies have most of all and that we lose very shortly afterwards, we can reclaim that. And when we know that that is who we are at our core, that's when we rethink our whole relationship to existence and ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean by that fifth insight of finding our place in nature. So yes, I think it comes full circle in that way.
Absolutely. Before we wrap up the program, three final questions.
Yeah.
Who is Alan Hunter?
Alan Hunter is a man who studied at Oxford University and got his doctorate and then wasn't sure what to do with it. But what he discovered was that the knowledge or the wisdom that exists in literature can be a powerful guiding force, that if we listen to it, if we compare what we read, if we look at people in the world around us, that wisdom is reflected back to us, and it will give us enough to power us through the whole extent of our days. But we can't live without doing that. So that's who Alan Hunter is.
And what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing?
Oh, well, we all have ego dreams of what we'll achieve. But I'll tell you what gives me pleasure. Perhaps that's the best thing, and that is, when some student writes to me, as someone did the other day, and just says, you know, I haven't stopped thinking about your classes in the 10 years since I graduated. And I go, oh, I think I touched someone.
Mm-hmm.
When a student writes to me and says, a former student says, you know, those talks we had about Shakespeare or the counseling exercises we did, they set me on a new course of life, and I'm grateful for them. Now that, it comes out of the blue. I don't expect it. I'm delighted when it arrives. But that makes me realize I'm not just wasting time and taking up space. I'm maybe contributing a little in my own ham-fisted way. And I think that's a very pleasant reassurance.
That's a great legacy. That's a great legacy. And finally, how powerful are we?
We're as powerful as we decide to be. Most people don't think they can be powerful in any reasonable way. That's the Marianne Williamson quotation. But actually, if we mobilize everything we've got and use it appropriately, we can change everything around us. And that's true whether you're raising a child and loving that child, who may change the future, or whether you're one of the great leaders of all time, Mohandas Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela. These are people who are doing exactly the same as the rest of us. They're using everything they've got as often as they possibly can. And it all matters.
Alan Hunter, author of Gratitude and Beyond, has been my guest. I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program. This has been wonderful.
It's been such a pleasure to talk with you. It's been very stimulating. Thank you for including me.
You bet. And if you are wanting to hear more of the entire 1 hour and 20-minute interview with Alan Hunter, then you can go to richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, and hear the full interview. Again, thanks to my guest, Alan Hunter, author of the book Gratitude and Beyond, Five Insights for a Fulfilled Life. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choice. Choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.